I'm Mark Watts. I'm a journalist. I'm currently the coordinator of the FOIA Center, which is specializes in what we call open access research. I've been a journalist for a long time, was previously the editor of Exero, the investigative website.
Can you tell us about the FOIA Center and the sorts of bits of information? Because I know this is FOI, Freedom of Information.
Yeah, that's right. So it does specialize in accessing information using the Freedom of Information Act, but it's not limited to that. It's wider in the sense that it uses open access laws in general. So it uses Freedom of Information Acts or their equivalents around the world, but it accesses information through corporate registers, corporate filings, courts, etc. So any way that sort of information that is basically in the public domain and is accessible, albeit that very few people know how to access it.
Yes, I was hearing recently that you can even access military contract details and things like that. So it's actually, this is an absolute goldmine potentially for journalists that they don't necessarily know about. But for the layman,
yes,
or
right,
woman, what about FOI requests on various aspects of the way we're governed? Is there can you just take us through the basics of that? What information can we get and what information can't we get?
Well, it is a bit complicated in practice because in theory, any information held by government bodies is accessible via the Freedom of Information Act. However, there are a whole series of possible exemptions that can be, as it were, deployed by government bodies in refusing such requests for information. Some of these exemptions are, as it were, what they call absolutes, meaning if they apply, then the information is not disclosable. So anything that's deemed, for example, to breach national security would fall into that category. But then most of the exemptions are what they call sort of discretionary, where a public interest balance exercise needs to be carried out, weighing up the potential public interest in disclosure versus the public interest in non-disclosure. So when it comes to contracts of any type, let alone military contracts, that exemption could come into play because there is an exemption for what's regarded as commercially confidential information. But then an assessment has to be made if information is indeed commercially confidential, and of course it isn't necessarily, but if it is, then an exercise has to be carried out between the public interest in disclosure versus the public interest in non-disclosure. And this is regulated by a body called the Information Commissioner's Office, which acts as, if you like, the watchdog or the police officer role in this area. It's a body to whom you can complain as the person making the request if a request has been refused and you think wrongly. And that body will adjudicate, and that's like the first rung of a potential appeals process. It is, however, completely starved of resources, and in practice, it's extremely slow. So it's quite a system to navigate.
It is. And how reliable is the information we get? Is there any examples where actually people have asked for information and they've got the wrong information?
I don't know about that. I mean, sometimes when a request is made, they don't really quite address the question or the request that was originally filed, and they might be doing that more as a way of avoiding disclosing something. So you ask for X and they end up coming back and saying, well, we don't have Y, so therefore we can't give it to you, and Y is slightly different from X but subtly different, and it's a kind of ruse. I've certainly had personal experience of that. But in terms of the information itself, if indeed it should end up being disclosed to you, how reliable is it? Well, I mean, it depends. I mean, you certainly can report on it, as long as you're reporting on it in a fair and accurate way. It would be covered by a qualified privilege in much the same way as, I don't know, reporting proceedings of Parliament, because it's actually is a disclosure by a government body, by an official body. So as such, it is, you're protected in terms of reporting it. Whether it's accurate or not, well, that depends. It may be, it may not be.
Well, there are also some quite grey areas about government, aren't there? And I wonder how, for example, the royal family fits in with this, whether that is considered to be legitimate for people to be asking questions about how that's run. I mean, there's actually large amounts of public money, of course, goes to aid these already very wealthy people. I'm not trying not to make a judgment about the system of a monarchy. But is that considered fair game for these FOI requests? Because one would have hoped so.
Pretty much no. I mean, there are sort of there is information that can be accessed, but in a very limited scope. There tends to be a kind of all-round exemption when it comes to royal matters. For some reason, they like to put a veil over anything to do with royal issues.
Well, I wonder why. Anyway, what about your letter to Private Eye? Because I understand that you've got a little bit frustrated with them recently, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, Private Eye has, this really concerns the issue of what's sort of become known as VIP paedophiles. So evidence of various people in elite positions over many, many years of having sexually abused children and basically getting away with it because of who they are or who they were. And Private Eye, I mean, admittedly, in common with much of the media, has very much joined the bandwagon to say that it's all so much stuff and nonsense. And they've rather taken in recent years to attacking any survivors who've come forward with testimony or may have written a book or whatever it may be, as well as whistleblowers or journalists who are working in this area. And it's curious because I think for a lot of people from the outside, because long ago Private Eye had something of a track record of uncovering evidence of this kind of thing. So in fact, Private Eye was quite early in terms of exposing specifically Cyril Smith in the wake of some disclosures by a small kind of alternative paper up in Rochdale. But that's largely down to the work of a lot of this was being pursued by Paul Foote, the late Paul Foote, who of course worked for Private Eye. And I think in many ways, Private Eye sorely misses him and his influence. Because in recent years, as I say, it's taken to attacking anybody who has sought to suggest that there is a significant problem of people, members of the elite, over the years having sexually abused children and not being prosecuted, notwithstanding the stacks of evidence that's now emerged in terms of failure to prosecute several former MPs at the time and other VIP figures, the old ambassador and so on. And just recently they've published a kind of series of these articles that appear from time to time, which was specifically about an article that I had written for the Foyer Center, because Foyer Center has a news site, so there's some articles about some an array of subjects there, and I'd written about in fact a book that's just been published by Simon Danjuk and his co-author Dan Smith. And then Simon Danjuk did quite a lot of the work a few years ago in terms of really bringing to light a lot of details about Cyril Smith specifically, because he was the MP for the same seat many years, obviously, after Cyril Smith had died. And Simon and Dan had written a book called Scandal at Dolphin Square, which is mostly about an array of curious figures, shall we say, curious or interesting, or possibly both, who've lived at Dolphin Square and been involved in one scandal or another. And they tackle the subject specifically of child sexual abuse in there. And one of the things that they do, the main part of that section of the book, is some statements that were signed by a former detective at the Met, Metropolitan Police, who'd worked for the paedophile unit there, who gave details of what had hitherto, up until the signing of his statement at least, been a secret operation that the Met carried out dating into the late 90s into allegations of child sexual abuse at sex parties involving political, government and military figures at Dolphin Square and other locations. And he describes in these statements how Met bosses and Special Branch thwarted this investigation. Now, this statement, he signed a couple of statements for the Met for its more recent Operation Winter Key, which was looking back at these sort of old cases, if you like. And these statements were, in fact, passed to the government inquiry into child sexual abuse. And curiously, it's been hugely ignored. I mean, the media at large has totally ignored it. The only coverage it got when this material first came to light was in a Twitter thread that I had put out back in 2016 when this evidence first, as it were, became public. And it was totally ignored by the media at the time. But this book goes into some detail about these statements. And Private Eye did this very skewed article sort of about the book, about what I had written about the book, as it were. And sort of as Private Eye has taken to doing, to sort of dismissing and kind of turning what I call turning a blind eye to the evidence. So they completely ignore the stuff about this former detective and just engages in sort of name calling and being very dismissive of the idea, you know, that there's an issue concerning VIP pedophiles. So my letter essentially took issue with, why have you ignored this this extraordinary evidence which has surfaced, which everyone seems to be so keen to ignore, but which this book is all about.
Yeah. The book is, so
before I just go on, I slightly misstated that. The book's not all about that. I mean, the section that's about child sexual abuse is predominantly about this material from this former detective at the Met. Have I had a reply? No. Private Eye has something of a track record of never publishing rights to reply. It does this very unusual journalistic practice of never contacting people. They've written about me and people I know around this issue, as I say, repeatedly over recent years, and they frequently do not contact people in advance of publication, and they constantly get things wrong as a consequence of that failure to carry out basic journalistic exercises. And then having got something wrong or having misled their readers over one thing or another, certainly my experience has been, if you write a letter, short letter for publication, they just ignore it, don't publish it.
Wow. I mean, it's amazing, really, that Private Eye had this journey from exposing people like Cyril Smith now to the point where actually they almost seem to be deliberately getting it wrong, if that's fair to say, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, I remember sort of saying to in one of his letters, I think I wrote some while ago over a much earlier article, I said, anyone would think you've joined the establishment. I think a lot of people think they have. They make play of, you know, being anti-establishment, of, you know, poking fun at establishment figures, which is all very well and good. But when it comes to really holding power to account, there's not much sign of it at Private Eye. So when it comes over this particularly sensitive and crucial issue of, you know, the sexual abuse of children carried out by, you know, various members of what you might call the establishment over the years and having got away with it. And I think this is speculation, but you may recall that there was a senior police officer who the Eye effectively identified, this is again many years ago, as having been involved in sexual abuse of children, along with other media outlets, a guy called Gordon Anglesey, and he sued Private Eye successfully. And it was a traumatic experience all around, not least because a key witness who basically alleged he'd been sexually abused by Anglesey took his own life in the wake of that, having to give evidence and, you know, and of the case going horribly wrong. Now, you can never say exactly what led someone's decision to take their own life, but it was a traumatic experience all around, I think it's fair to say. And one can't help but feel that the Eye has kind of ended up thinking it's much easier to decry people who allege that they were sexually abused by powerful figures, rather than looking into these stories and just weighing up the evidence objectively.
Yeah, I wonder, as a journalist, what you think the role of the lawyers is. I mean, certainly years ago, interviewing Roger Cook, he said they had a permanent barrister on the Cook Report program, making sure that every legal angle was explored in order to try and make sure that the public could see whatever he'd recorded, because there were constantly lawyers on the other side trying to do the opposite. And I wonder, you know, how that balance of power, legal balance of power, has changed over the last decade or maybe even 20 years when it comes to, you know, doing everything that journalists possibly can to get information out to the public, which some people want to make sure never does.
Yeah, I think the thing, I mean, I think the situation has in some ways got worse in some respects, but in other ways there have been improvements. So it's got worse in as much as what I think increasingly journalists are having to face when they're tackling very difficult subjects, when they're taking on powerful people concerning any allegations they don't want aired or any evidence that seems to suggest that they may have been up to no good. What happens these days quite often is people who are subject to those kind of questions, shall we say, get their lawyers to file letters in advance of any publication appearing, and quite often you find yourself engaged in a lengthy, almost like a pre-legal pre-litigation rather exchange, which can in itself be quite expensive. You know, one can't help but feel that's part of the strategy sometimes, at least. And that's a difficulty that I'm not sure was there quite so much in years gone by. In some ways, things have become a bit easier, in as much as there have been reforms to the Defamation Act, which is the thing that's primarily caused problems in the past. So there've been improvements there, perhaps the key one being that, there has to be what's called serious harm to reputation before, you know, as a basic grounding before a libel action can be sought. And in practice, that actually gets rid of quite a lot of the kinds of cases that were threatened or filed in the past. But then having said that, you've got privacy as an issue that's increasingly engaged by lawyers. You know, it's surprising how often lawyers manage to sort of interpret almost any exposure of anything that they may have been up to as somehow a breach of their privacy. They can sort of manage to almost get anything in that category. They'll certainly argue the case for it. So privacy has become much more of a problem. But just going back to what I was saying about the whole issue that the Eye faced when it was sued by Gordon Anglesey, it's worth saying that many, many years later, of course, Anglesey was convicted. So although he was successful in his libel actions against the Eye and the other publications, who he said had effectively accused him of being a paedophile, he was successful in suing them, because obviously it's a highly damaging thing to say about somebody. That certainly counts as causing serious harm in the circumstances where he had no, you know, he hadn't had a conviction at the time. But some years later, he did have a conviction. He was convicted of that very offence for what he'd done many years before. So, I mean, that does show the difficulty of the whole subject area. I mean, perhaps not surprisingly, anybody who gets caught in the eye of such allegations invariably ends up denying it. And well, they would do, wouldn't they? They would deny it if it's false, but also they would deny it if it's true.
Today, we've had the last of 47 police officers in Rotherham on the topic of child abuse to be investigated over the handling of historic allegations of child sexual abuse in Rotherham, was cleared of misconduct. So actually, nobody has even lost their job as a result of the horrific sexual abuse going on in the town. Many, many reports to the police of it, but no action taken. Nearly 1,500 girls subjected to sexual exploitation over 16 years. Many officers, something like 50 officers knew of this, had reports directly to them of this sexual abuse going on. Obviously, this is a crime, and yet no action has been taken against them for literally ignoring these crimes going on in the city and around.
Well, my understanding is that what's happened today is the final officer who was facing, as it were, serious disciplinary action has been cleared. And putting that issue aside, what that means is that apparently nobody at South Yorkshire Police did anything wrong. Now, I'm not I'm not saying anything about the individual officer who was cleared today. I know nothing about him or what he actually did or didn't do. But standing back from that, looking at the actions of South Yorkshire Police overall, I mean, it's clear to everyone that there was a massive foul up and apparently no individual officer did anything wrong. And yet South Yorkshire Police committed this massive foul up. So that's obviously a very unsatisfactory position. It suggests that there's a systemic problem and or a cultural problem. And it's a little bit difficult to accept the idea that no one did anything wrong at all. Maybe everyone did something wrong. Yes, it's completely appalling. I mean, it's just absolutely appalling.
Isn't it Alexis Jay who did the report into what happened in Rotherham? Mm. She has now taken on a much bigger role in the national inquiry. So it seems That's as right. if there is this new way of dealing with this where nobody, I mean, I would have thought at the very least you would have misconduct in public office if police officers have been informed of crime, statements have been made to them, etc., and those statements have simply not been acted on through the criminal justice system.
Yes, I mean, I'm just thinking about some of the investigations that the sort of Home Office sponsored inquiry that Alexis J is still running. It's still going on. It's coming to its sort of closing stages now. I think all the investigative reports have been published. We're just waiting for the final report. I think that's where we are. And if you take, for example, the investigation into why Greville Janner, the late Labour MP, later Lord Janner, why he was never prosecuted over allegations. Basically, as I recall the report, it talks about a failure, a repeated failure, properly to investigate allegations that surfaced. And moreover, even where they were investigated reasonably, and the reasonable evidence was put to the prosecutors of the day, there was a failure to prosecute. Now, I'm tracking my memory as to whether she identifies individuals who made errors. I've got a feeling she didn't quite do that. I think she talked about institutional failures. And quite often that is what we're talking about. I mean, she's thinking just in terms of what's going on now in terms of prosecuting sexual offenders generally, there's clearly a massive problem at the CPS, which is born in large part from a complete lack of resources. And it seems to me for some time to have been something, become something of a dysfunctional organization because of lack of resources. Now, there have been all sorts of reforms that have been made to the approach of prosecutors. And actually, credit needs to go to Keir Starmer for this. Back in his days as DPP, Director of Public Prosecutions, he brought in a lot of these reforms. Quite often, by the private eye lobby and the kind of anti, the body that wants to attack survivors or people who at least allege sexual abuse, they've attacked him, the history of attacking him for these reforms, which are all about debunking the myths about the nature of witnesses. Not just dismissing them out of hand because of problems that there might be in terms of, inconsistencies in their account, the fact they may have reported late, didn't report at the time, it was many years later. And he introduced a kind of a template for what those stereotypes are that need to be avoided by prosecutors. So there have been good reforms so far as the prosecution of such cases are concerned, but actually things are in a terrible state. And I think one of the main reasons why they're in such a poor state is because there's a complete lack of resources or just inadequate level of resources for prosecutors to do their work, to assess cases and so on. Now, if one were to look at any individual failures now, to what extent would it be down to the given official who signed off a case, no action here, perhaps because there may be inadequate time to weigh it up, or a feeling that they don't want to, that the threshold is rather high than more likely than not of successful conviction, which is the test they're supposed to apply. to what extent is that individual official's responsibility, and to what extent is it in fact a systemic thing because of lack of resources? I mean, it can be quite hard to ascribe faults, but at the end of the day, if you want to reform these organisations, these failing organisations, whether it be South Yorkshire Police or the CPS, you do need to get to grips with what's gone wrong. And only when you've got to grips with what's gone wrong in the past and who got it wrong and where it went wrong, are you really going to have much chance of really changing things.
I suppose the mother of all cases has got to be Jimmy Savile. This came up a couple of months ago in the House of Commons with Boris Johnson accusing Keir Starmer of saying, well, you were prosecuting journalists and failing to prosecute Jimmy Savile. And there was a massive hoo-ha afterwards. What do you think's the rights and wrongs of this? Did Starmer actually fail to prosecute Savile?
No, I mean, what Boris Johnson said there was utter twaddle. So the failure to prosecute Savile, there's evidence, there's material around which makes it completely clear that this is not at Keir Starmer's door. However, he was the person who, as it came to light, as it were, that this massive failure had happened years before. I mean, this was after Savile had died. It came to light that there'd been this massive failure. That's what prompted Keir Starmer to introduce these reforms as to how to go about making decisions about prosecuting sex abuse cases of all types. And because it was felt, the conclusion he drew was that in the past there'd been a failure to properly assess witnesses who come forward to allege sexual abuse, a failure that I think is going on still widely in society, much of our media and indeed a private eye, that these people are too easily dismissed. And it was that prompted him to draw up this kind of template of the common myths and stereotypes to watch out for when assessing such evidence and when deciding whether or not to prosecute. And actually what has been shown, despite many inadequacies of the Home Office-sponsored inquiry that's being run by Alexis J, what has become crystal clear is that time and time again, especially when it came to members of the elite sexually abusing children, or at least allegations of doing so, that there were the assessments made of those witnesses coming forward to make those allegations was, you know, very skewed. It was very skewed against them and very much in favour of the establishment figures who were being accused. It was out of balance.
Yeah, well, we've had this rather horrible situation with the guy known as Nick, who came forward with evidence and then himself was prosecuted in jail. Well, this doesn't send the right message to those who have been abused but are afraid to come forward.
Well, that's fair comment. I mean, I have some real concerns about the trial. I attended the trial in full that happened in Newcastle Crown Court a few years ago now, where he was prosecuted. I think there were real problems with that trial. But certainly he was prosecuted and convicted. And as you say, he's in jail still.
Mark, where can people follow your work? Where's the best place to find? And also, of course, if people are interested in getting more information about Freedom of Information requests.
Yeah, so well, the Forest Centre has a website, and it has a new section on the website which has some interesting articles on it, including the one we were talking about earlier. So that's at www.foyercentre.com. So FOIA stands, of course, for Freedom of Information Act. Centre, English spelling, C-E-N-T-R-E, so foyercentre.com. And I am on Twitter. I have a Twitter handle. It's @MarkWatts_1.
Mark Watts, thanks very much for joining us.
Good to speak to you.